It's Friday morning, and that means another edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. My son and partner, Jeremy, and I take a look at one or two, maybe more issues every week and discuss them in as civil and respectful a way as we possibly can, especially when we disagree. And so, how are you, Jer? How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing well because it's my son's birthday. So happy birthday, Jer.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we'll continue a conversation at the grill later on in the day where we won't talk about any podcast talk.
We'll just
talk about
gardening and family, or family and gardening. How about that order?
That's pretty much it. So I'm torn. On one hand, there was a lot going on this week. A probable deal on infrastructure plan, and yet a long way to go on that. The Iranian president saying that he would not meet with Joe Biden and wants no interference with their nuclear development. Kind of a dance that's going on between the United States and Iran. There is also a comprehensive bill on gun violence, a deal, it appears, that's imminent on police reform. This is all going on in 1 week and more. But I don't want to talk about that. We will next week, because all of this will be ongoing next week. When we closed the podcast last week, we promised that we would get into the issue of critical race theory, which is fast becoming an issue in the congressional campaign of 2022, and a wedge issue at that between Democrats and Republicans. And I have some thoughts. I know you do too. So I'll fire away as normal, and then you respond.
Okay.
Critical race theory, as it's defined, is taking an upside down and comprehensive view of American history, not so much from the point of view of our ideals and our aspirations, but more so from the realities of history, and ensuring that we don't teach American history and then leave a little corner for a little discussion on Black history or on the history of Hispanics or Asian Pacific Americans, nor do we integrate American history with some side stories here and there about people of color, but that we recognize that actually from the very beginning, that American history was actually a melange of a number of people's histories and their interactions, and that the country, as well as the aspirations that define this country, as well as the violence and the injustice that has defined our history, has got to be a major part of our understanding of the full story of the United States. So much of the United States and our history going back to the colonial days has to do with race and the injustices that surround race. So I, for one, am a great believer that if we are going to try seriously to move beyond racism in this country, institutional racism as well as racism within our hearts and minds, that it's absolutely essential that the 1619 Project, that critical race theory within the context of education, within the context of corporate hiring, within the context of the operations of companies and not-for-profits, within the broad context of how we deal with each other as a people, must be taught and must be trained and must be a part of who we are. That otherwise we've seen that we've always seen that white supremacy is part of our history, but we've seen that with the wrong kind of leadership and the really sinister kind of manipulation that we've had, that white supremacy can rise to the forefront. It is an important force that has to be dealt with, and can't be dealt with only by law enforcement, only by the church and synagogue and mosque, but it has to be done by society as a whole. And so color me then as a person who strongly believes that critical race theory has got to be has got to be integrated in our lives. Now, after you comment in the course of our conversation, I'm going to discuss how this is a troublesome issue politically for Democrats. But I wanted to at least state my views up front about how important CRT is, critical race theory.
You know, what you laid out is very familiar to me. And I think I don't know what percentage of Americans, but at least for millennials and Gen Z, what you laid out is multiculturalism. And that is a model that took root in the 60s and is dominant in higher education and in a lot of states across America is standard history. I don't think that's critical race theory. I think critical race theory goes much farther to the left. The notion of multiculturalism, you know, take like the quintessential historical approach to multiculturalism is Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. And what, you know this because you gave me, you basically assigned me to read the book before my professors did, was instead of looking at history from the top down, generals and the important statesmen, which tended to obviously slant towards the white majority population, Howard Zinn turned it upside down. And, the book starts from the perspective of the natives of Hispaniola, where Columbus basically conquered. And it takes it from there, more of a grassroots on the left side of history. That's, I want to say, has almost been standard for 30, 40 years now, definitely in higher education and in a lot of school districts across the country. The problem with critical race theory is not only is it antagonistic, not only is it extreme, but it's also dangerous. And here I'm going to go for the jugular of critical race theory, is that one of the extensions or one of the ideas of critical race theory, and a lot of people have heard about this, is the notion of white privilege. And the notion that it's really just a repackaging of Marxist style dialectic historical materialism, where, Karl Marx came to the conclusion that during the Industrial Revolution, it was the proletariat and it was the industrialist capitalists that were the antagonizing class. This has repackaged itself in a racial way, where the oppressor mainly are African Americans, and the oppressed are African Americans, and the oppressor is the white male. White male privilege is the moniker we hear on social media and the media every day. And I have to say, this is where I go for the jugular. That is a violation of civil rights. And for the party and for the movement that came up with the civil rights movement in the 60s, I have to ask, where is their sanity? Because Martin Luther King encapsulated it best when he said, we should judge people by the content of their character and not the color of their skin. And in that ethos came the Civil Rights Act, which when I was a kid, in any state test we took, whether it was third grade, fourth grade, always at the bottom it said, New York State does not discriminate based on race, color of skin, religion, creed, disability, gender, and so on. But inherent in critical race theory is a violation of civil rights, is a view that white people are born with a privilege, that white people are inherently racist. And I have to say, that goes against the ethos of Martin Luther King. It goes against the ethos of the Democratic Party that they built their platform on from the civil rights movement. Now, that's me going after the jugular. Now we get into the actual, you know, the further into the issue. And I say this, if social issues were an onion, the issue of race would be the outer layer, quite figuratively and quite literally, because race is just the outer shell. It's an important issue, but it's only scratching the surface. So as you get to the core of the social onion, what is the core? It's human suffering. All humans suffer. I can think of two things that all of humanity have in common. One is about 99% of our genetic makeup. The second is that we all suffer. Whether it's a black kid in Bedford-Stuyvesant or Chirac who grows up not knowing his father and is lured into gang violence and ends up in a prison cell, or whether it's a white kid in the panhandle of Florida whose mother went to the doctor because of excruciating pain and the doctor gave her opioids and she got addicted to opioids. And she then went to heroin and now prostitutes her body to get her fix. That is the story of, if not hundreds of thousands of white Americans and people of all color and skin, but maybe even millions. There are white communities that are ravaged by crystal meth, by crack, by heroin, you name the drug. It's not just drugs. Human suffering is an element, is a reality of the human condition. That's in the present. And when you go in history, you go way back. So let's say the Great Wall of China. The Great Wall of China is also known as the Long Grave because 400,000 people who were forced into building it were buried in the Great Wall of China. There is a language family today known as Slavic people. What is the root word of Slav? Slave. Essentially, when you talk to a Polish person or a Ukrainian or whatever, and you say, oh, you know, that Slavic person, you're calling them a slave. Because I have read more white people under the Ottoman slave system were bought and sold on the human market in the 19th century than in the entirety of American history. Yet we don't know about that. The problem with critical race theory is it victimizes African Americans and exclusively focuses on the victimization, which is dehumanizing, ignores the rest of history as a standard of human suffering across time and space. And like I said, it's dehumanizing because it only focuses on victimization. But what if you flipped it on its head and you look at how much the African Americans have achieved? I'm going to quote somebody who I know you disagree with, and I actually have criticisms as well. Larry Elder. Boy, he gets people, you know, their blood boiling. But he shared a statistic which I find unbelievably fascinating. And I wish I could write to him and ask him the formula for the statistic, and I might do that. But I'm going to take him at his word. He said, if you take the black nation, the African Americans in this nation today, and you isolate the economy just to them, that's the 15th largest GDP in the world. That's more than half of European nations. So I agree with multiculturalism and I agree with looking at the history of oppression, but to put it front and center as the experience of African Americans, as I keep saying, is dehumanizing and it's misleading for a people who have achieved, whether it was under slavery let's say after slavery, rebuilding their family in the face of Jim Crow. And I mean, in no special order, in just the last, you know, 15 years of my life, Colin Powell, Susan Rice, Condi Rice, Loretta Lynch, you know, Kamala Harris, Barack Obama, elected twice with an overwhelming majority, Eric Holder, scores of statesmen at the federal and the state and local levels. So I would stop right there, and I do have more to say, but I think I did say a lot.
You did. And my blood is simmering. So Just wait until it cools. No, look, there is a lot there that I agree with, and I am not a fan of the history of victimization, because I do believe that it demeans people. It's only part of a story. The real story is the triumph, as you point out, over the victimization. On the other hand, fast forward to this minute, and we know that despite progress, especially a lot of visible progress, upfront progress on television, in the world of expertise, and so on, that there are many people of color, particularly African Americans, Black Americans, who have transcended a system that in many ways is geared against them. On the flip side of that, there is still a system that we have seen rise to the forefront and become visible again, that discriminates by police, discriminates by hiring, discriminates by board membership, discriminates by in the court system, discriminates in almost every facet of our life, whether I or you or anyone feel that we experience white privilege. Fact of the matter is, the odds are more with us than they are with people of color. And whether or not that means that you have to beat yourself with chains over a sense of guilt or not, I do think it has to be something that we recognize and understand, that that aspiration of in order to build a more perfect union, we still have a long ways to go. In fact, as we speak right now, Derek Chauvin, prime example of what we're talking about, is about to be sentenced sometime, I guess, in the afternoon. And that's only the most visible and probably most awful example of a lot of criminal justice and police discrimination that takes place. Bottom line here is that we don't need to denigrate American history and the American experience. We don't have to make whites feel as if we have to wear a loincloth for the rest of our lives and expiate our guilt in the treatment, particularly of our forefathers towards blacks, and up to the present day. But we have to deal with what is stronger than a sentiment, almost a pathology within the black community, that has internalized the fact that that there are reasons why black kids lag in school, why, yes, there are those who can succeed and maneuver through the system. There are many others that can't. And perhaps above all, that there's still a rage. You know, I remember pointing out to you guys when you were younger and Louis Farrakhan would be on television. He would be on that public access channel on cable. And I'd say, look at the audience. And the audience were black doctors and lawyers and professionals. And had to wonder, well, why are they angry? Need to ask them. They're very angry. There's a role that they feel they have to play. There's a discomfort, even still, I'm going to say much more of a discomfort among people over 50, black and white and Latino, than there is among millennials and Gen Z. But I think we are a whole lot better served by actually treating the issue of racism as a cancer, and rather than allow the possibility of it continuing to ravage, our body or metastasize into something even worse, like a race war, that what we attempt to do is isolate it, treat it, and then inoculate it from the future of spreading, which is through education and through hiring.
Well, you have to ask, where does the rage come from? And there is organic rage, but there's also synthetic rage. There's also rage that's, there's grassroots rage, but there's also AstroTurf rage. And you look at the media coverage, and I mean, from time to time, when I do watch NBC News, and actually, you know, watch some mini documentary series during last summer, during the summer of riots. And I was just appalled by the coverage and the overt victimization. They, you know, you talk about white supremacy. There is white supremacy. Quite frankly, it's not shocking. There's racism all over the world. In fact, I would argue where the least, among the least racist nations, for obvious reasons other than the statistic of African Americans being isolated, you know, if they were their own nation, the 15th largest GDP. How could that happen in a nation built that's ravaged by white supremacy? I think the white supremacy is exaggerated. I cite the statistic that the Southern Law Poverty Center says that the KKK has about a 7,000 membership organization. I mean, they would want to, the KKK would obviously want to blow that up and make it look bigger, to make it look more mainstream. But I mean, 7,000 in a nation of 320 million. So now you got to get into, well, let's read people's minds and let's say that it's inherent in their unconscious. And look, I mean, how do you quantify that? How do you qualify that? The fact of the matter is, I return to the media and their coverage. They ignore the fact that, and I've cited the statistic before, there are more white people that die at the hands of police officers. And yet we can't name one white person. Why is that? Because they're not focusing on it. Because if it bleeds, it leads. And I don't know, maybe there is an agenda in the sense that they want to put, you know, the much of the corporate media want to put race front and center, which, you know, would basically reveal that they don't have independent journalism. You shouldn't push agendas in the news. You should investigate. You talked about lagging behind in school. A lot of that has to do with the family structure. The family structure that was once strong before the war on poverty and the war on crime. So a lot of this stems from the horrific legislation that both Republicans, progressive Republicans and progressive Democrats passed that decimated Black communities that were still behind, but were making incredible progress at a rate never seen before. And so you just have to ask yourself, how much of this eventually becomes divide and conquer? What good comes out of making, you know, going back to my analogy, the onion as social issues, taking the outer layer of humanity and saying this is the most important lens to understand society and its inner workings. It's just not, when we know that human suffering is a universal thing. How do we tell people that Black suffering is more important than Hispanic or white suffering or Chinese suffering or whatever? How do we do that? And again, I would just say that a lot of what you're talking about is more multiculturalism. The very essence of critical race theory is very extremist and very hateful. And it really does abuse civil rights.
Well, I think that critical race theory is an antidote, in that it does allow, and you know, the scholarship has to be right. The story has to be true, but it does allow for a venting. It does allow for a catharsis. It does allow for discussion. I think above all, what it does is it opens the door to empathy, so that instead of, if it's pure history of victimization, we are studying the other or them. But if we're talking about a curriculum or a program that gets at the why of the rage, the why of the discrimination, then what happens is that I think we're studying each other and moving into the shoes of the other. So it's no, that person, black if you're white, white if you're black, get to understand each other as a human being. Hence the reason why it deserves an upfront placement in curriculum, in training, and integrated throughout our lives. And so I like the notion of not going extreme, but going further than we normally do, not just simply to tell, an antiseptic story about the races and their success and their at times working with each other, but also talking about what the roots of rage are on both sides. Now, you mentioned the smallness of the Ku Klux Klan. I'm aware of that, and the various militias and the Posse Comitatus and all of those groups. But we have seen recently that the numbers of membership can have influence beyond their membership. You know, it used to be that the Klan would organize a rally in some state, including a famous one in Skokie, Illinois. And, you know, 10, 15, 25 Klan members would show up, perhaps a few other people, and the media would treat it as the main event on the news, mainly because there were thousands of protesters against it. But we've seen in Charlottesville, and we've seen in Washington, D.C., and we've seen then culminating on January 6th, 2021, something that we should and cannot ever forget, how deep that influence of a few can be. That was a riot. That was a hostile attempt at takeover. That was violent. And that could be the first of many more, unless we attempt to root it out and even do more than a congressional panel and congressional study. And I will end my comments right there. Why don't you go ahead and get the last word?
Well, I think it's convenient to take those two things and then put them together and say, well, you know, January 6th was really all about racism. I don't know how we qualify that. I don't know how we quantify that. But I don't want to get into that debate, because all I want to say about that, about January 6th and some of the information that's coming out, remember, my approach to history is that of a police investigator. I take disparate trails of information and I ask the old Roman question, cui bono, who benefits? And I supplant that question with evidence, the best evidence that you can find. And so there's a Reuters article that came out a few months ago that I would invite people to read. And I could cite a lot more sources than just this, but I don't want to overwhelm people. Start with this. Google Reuters, Enrique Tarrio, and FBI asset. Enrique Tarrio is the head of the Proud Boys. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting that the head of the Proud Boys is a Hispanic man. But, you know, I digress. But the real substance of what I'm saying is the Reuters article goes into detail using court hearing documents from 2014 and 15 that Enrique Tarrio was an asset of the FBI. I find it very difficult to believe that intelligence units lose track of their assets. It kind of be like saying like a successful investor, you know, is holding CDs at a AAA rated bank and says, well, you know, it was the best return. I just can't remember which bank it was. I mean, investors don't lose trail of their money. Intelligence don't lose trail of their assets. Enrique Tarrio, Reuters.com, FBI asset, according to court hearing documents. He, of course, says, I don't recall. What does that mean? So that's a unique perspective, because Proud Boys were front and center in the media as far as pinning the blame on January 6th. But this is a completely different topic. It just really goes back to critical race theory and looking at what people on the ground and in higher education are doing and saying. And it really has the hallmark of extremism, of enforcing guilt, shutting down debate. I mean, a person who is knee deep in or even eyeball deep in critical race theory, you can't even engage in a discussion with them. I mean, just go on YouTube and look at how some of these followers of this belief engage in their debates. They get personal, they get emotional, they get sometimes violent. If we're going to have a marketplace of ideas, especially, and we expect that from universities, we can't take this form of activism that borders on violence and encourage it and shut down debate. But that's what they're doing. But that's at the ground level. The problem is that Silicon Valley are engaging in this. Silicon Big Tech have sophisticated algorithms that basically make or break what becomes viral and what becomes part of the mainstream social media narrative. And you just simply can't have that. You can't have CEOs that favor, or you can favor that viewpoint of history, but you can't shut the alternative down and say, well, if it doesn't agree with us, it's racist. That's the essence. You go by the actions, not by the words, and that's the essence of critical race theory.
So I'm going to violate what I said a few minutes ago and take the last word, and that is, it just occurred to me that I promised that I would make the case that I think critical race theory as a political issue, I think, is deadly for the Democrats. And you see Republicans, conservatives, going after critical race theory and trying to paint Democrats with a broad brush, that critical race theory is downgrading America, number one, that it is socialistic and consistent with the socialistic philosophy and dominance of the Democratic Party, and that Republicans are using it not simply in the congressional races, but as well in local races as an effort to shore up and build up the party. They're from the bottom up. Their hope is that they can win back some suburban voters who've been voting Democrat, but don't want to go too far. The further problem, and I'll just leave it at this note for the Democrats, is that being bombarded with something as complex as critical race theory not only puts Democrats on the disadvantage, but how do you combat it? What's the bumper sticker? There are too many howevers, but let me explain. And if I could just have the opportunity to sit down with you, you know, score, I think, an advantage to Republicans by continuing to raise this. I'm not saying it's a legitimate argument. I'm just stepping aside and being a political analyst and consultant. And I'm going to sign off. You can have the last of the last words if you'd like.
Well, it'll just be my birthday wish. How about that?
Okay, no, that's what it looks.
I said a lot of criticism of critical race theory, but I don't want to just offer criticism. I want to offer a solution. Maybe I alluded to a solution in the very last thing that I said about shutting down debate. But if we're serious about having a free society And we don't want to go down the path of authoritarianism, because authoritarianism is not immune to this country. It didn't start with Trump. It started with the birth of the national security state. But if we want to have a free society, and we want to be a beacon for the world in that regard of a free society, then we need to have a holistic approach to teaching social sciences, history, and civics. And I don't think there should be one dominant form, because there are multiple viewpoints. And so just like somebody who decides, you know, conventional medicine isn't for me, I want holistic treatment, and there are, you know, I don't know, hundreds of ways to go about that, maybe we should take that model of holistic medicine and we should infuse that into our educational curriculums at the local and state levels. I don't think the federal government needs to determine for 50 states what it needs to be, but to encourage it and to offer a system of standards to say, here, you know, here's what you could and should be following, and we'll rate you based on where you fall short. But infuse critical race theory into the curriculum, fine. Infuse civics into the curriculum, fine, but not through just the lens of critical race theory. I'm talking about the ancient tradition of political science and checks and balances and knowing your rights and the different interpretations of rights. Infuse a patriot view, a patriotic view of history, looking at primarily maybe the Revolutionary War and why it was so revolutionary, and show people, look, we have this tendency today to do something very ahistorical, and that is refrain from the principles of history. You see a lot of these activists out there who have this mindset, a 21st century mindset, and they go back to 1776 and they say, well, why aren't you thinking like I think now? Well, that's just not how you study history. You immerse yourself, you go back in time, and then you work your way forward. And that is a very, you know, strong weakness of critical race theories, the lack of historical context and perspective. It's more like forcing a 21st century view on the past. And so we should just have this holistic approach of different viewpoints and different philosophies. And that's how we enrich in society. But I'm very concerned that there will be a drive to ram this down the throats by force. If we saw last summer's riots and the use of force, let's make sure that doesn't happen in an intellectual kind of way where there's a shutting out of debate, because we will no longer be a free society.
Well, what you've witnessed is the Zogby Report, the full-length movie. We went, I don't know how long we were, but we went long. But this was a very good conversation, and we've talked about this, but this is really the first time that I think that we've both gotten to air what we both feel, and this is how we do it normally. Good week to everybody, and we'll see what's up next week. I'm sure there'll be a lot to talk about, probably infrastructure and guns and all those issues that we bypassed today. Have a good week, Jer. See you later.
Take care.